realize from the very words of Imam Ali alayhi salam that he was a very beautiful, eloquent speaker and writer. We can see this very clearly in the book Nahjul Balagha, The Peak of Eloquence, which is a compilation of Imam Ali's sermons, his letters, and his short statements. Truly, we witness the beauty of the speech and the speaking ability and the writing ability and the eloquence of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and as it is referred to in Arabic as fasaha and balagha. And so we find in sermon number 203 in Nahjul Balagha that Imam Ali alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, says, "When a man dies, people ask what property he has left behind, while the angels ask what good deeds he has sent forward. May Allah bless you. Send forward something, for it will be alone for you. And do not leave everything behind, for that would be a burden upon you." A very beautiful and profound statement. And of course, when each of us will die, people will ask what was left behind as inheritance, or what was left behind by so and so. But the angels who are waiting for us on the other side, waiting for us after the gate of death is crossed, those angels will ask us, "What good deeds have you sent forward?" So the property that was left behind will not be of any use, unless, of course, it is given away on the path of Allah. But what will be of use, and indeed of great use, is what we have sent forward. Imam Ali says, "May Allah bless you. Send forward something. Send good deeds forward. Whatever you have done in this life, which was for the sake of Allah, and it was on the path of Allah, that is what will be counted. That is what will be waiting for you, as if you have given out a loan, and it will come back to you." It is what we do in our lives, brothers and sisters, dear friends. It is what we do in our lives for the sake of Allah. In this temporary world, this world of trial, it is these good deeds which we will see in the hereafter, in the Akhirah. And so, as Imam Ali says, do not leave everything behind, because that would only be a burden upon you. For that which is left behind in this temporary world will be temporary, and it will be destroyed, and it will be vain. But that which we send forward will be saved for an eternity, where we too are to live for eternity. A profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
أسعد حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد محمد وآل محمد. اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله
Allah, I ask you for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil. And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger. And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In this program, I would like to talk about Amir al-Mu'mineen, not that much from the historical point of view, but I would like to share with you some of his words about himself in Nahj al-Balagha. Ali in the words of Ali. There is a khutbah in Nahj al-Balagha, khutbah number 3. Very powerful, very sensitive, where he actually lays down the reason why he has accepted this and what is his mandate. That's where he says that, you know, I knew this was my right from day one, but I was deprived. And after 25 years, people came back to him. And there he says, I have only accepted it because unlike the case of Saqifa, now I have the support of the people. So I don't have an excuse on the day of Qiyamah to say to Allah that, oh, people were not there with me. And number 2, he says, because Allah has taken a pledge on people like me that I am not allowed to be indifferent when I see the ummah divided between the oppressors and the oppressed. He went right in the beginning where he says, أَمَّا وَاللَّهِ لَقَدْ تَقَدْ مَصَحَ إِبْنَ أَبِي قَحَافَ وإنه إلا يعلم أن محل منها محل القطب من الرحى. He uses the word تقمّسَ. تقمّسَ is from قميص. تقمّسَ means to put on the shirt. It's a verb form here now. And so Amir al-Mu'minin says that by Allah, Ibn Abi Qahafa, referring to the first Khalifa, لقد تقمّسها. He put on the shirt of Khilafah while he knew it didn't fit him. It didn't fit those who were before. And the way Khilafah fits to him, he describes, he says, he knew, while he knew that my position to Khilafah is the position of the axis in relation to the handmill. The problem is, you know, this generation doesn't know what is a handmill. They have grinders at home, you know, all electrical. But just about 50 years ago, if people wanted to grind things, they would have this handmill at home. And this is how you get flour and other things. But for those two stones to work together, you needed a pole in the middle. And the stone at the top will have a hole in there, which you will fix on it, and then you will be able to move the stone on the top over the bottom. Otherwise, they will not really go together. It will not work properly. It will fall off. And this is what Amir al-Mu'minin says. If you look at Khilafat, if that handmill is the Khilafah, that pole in between, that's the Qutb. And that's me. The system of leadership and Khilafat of Islam, he says, I am there, in middle there. If you don't have it that, the system will not work properly. And this is where he says, and then, you know, after describing that, I am the central part of the system of Khilafat. Without me, it will not work.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Iran is a land of ethnic diversity, and that is reflected in different languages, cultures, and of course, music. After over a one-year hiatus due to the coronavirus, the Iranian Folk Music Festival has once again hosted musicians from across Iran, each playing their local tunes using their indigenous instruments.
I come from the northern Khorasan province. I am so happy to be part of this music festival, to share my city's music with my fellow Iranians from other cities. I've brought our local instruments, such as sonal, which is an ancient Iranian woodwind instrument, and dhol, which is a local type of drum.
We in Sistan and Baluchistan province play sitar, which we also call tambure. We also play qaychak, which is a type of a bowed lute, similar to kamanche. We usually play in celebrations.
Every night during the three-day festival, different local ensembles took to the stage to perform, so the audience could listen to Kurdish, Baluchi, Azeri, and Arabic tunes in a matter of a few hours. And this is my favorite part. On the sidelines of the festival, bands from different ethnicities get together and improvise. This is where music transcends languages and interconnects various cultures.
Music is a language that needs no translation. We may not understand each other's languages, but as you could see, different people are interacting peacefully through music.
It's so interesting to see artists from different parts of the country perform together. This is the true meaning of national unity that binds us despite our cultural differences.
And organizers say that's the main purpose of holding such an event, to unite different ethnicities through the language of music.
Music is an integral part of society's identity and history, and Iran is no exception. So the festival tries to both introduce the local music of different ethnic groups in Iran while establishing peace and friendship among them.
Organizers also hope that the festival would help revive Iran's folk music, which has long been overshadowed by some of the heavily invested genres, like pop.
Through music, it's easier to grasp the ethnic diversity in Iran, because music itself is a language, a universal language that speaks the beauty of differences and peaceful coexistence of different cultures as one nation. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Kerman.
The sanctions by the United Nations Security Council against North Korea over its nuclear and missile programs have been in place for more than a decade. The UN now acknowledges that the U.S.-backed sanctions were at least partly responsible for North Korea's food and medicine shortages.
DPR Korea has never been more isolated from the international community than at this point in time. This is having a dramatic impact on the human rights of the people inside of the country and dampens hopes of achieving sustainable peace and security on the Korean Peninsula.
The special rapporteur was echoing and backed the call by some member states for sanctions relief for North Korea.
There must be a move back towards the spirit of multilateral cooperation that enabled the foundation of the United Nations in the first place.
This weekend, the South Korean and U.S. envoys on North Korea met in Seoul, with South Korea calling for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War, and the U.S. agreeing to discuss the proposal later. The U.S. has often repeated that it's willing to meet with North Korea anywhere, anytime, without preconditions. U.S. officials have now added that the country holds no hostile intent toward North Korea, while at the same time pressing for stronger implementation of the controversial United Nations Security Council sanctions. South Koreans expressed their hope the international community could at least provide humanitarian aid.
The United Nations need to support North Koreans so that they don't continue to suffer from starvation.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in has sought to build peace with North Korea, arranging summits and proposing other avenues of engagement, while the U.S. maintained a hard line. President Moon will leave office next spring. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A Yemeni human rights group called the Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has released a report on casualties caused by 6 years of Saudi led war on Yemen. The report says more than 44,000 civilians have been killed or injured since 2015 when Riyadh launched an aggression against Sana'a. Thousands of women and children are among the victims, according to the report.
We released a report on the casualties of the Yemen war during the past 2,400 days of the conflict. 44,221 civilians were killed or injured, targeted by airstrikes and cluster bombs. More than 4,000 children and 2,800 women are among the victims who lost their lives.
Also, hundreds have been left with permanent disabilities. The report says thousands of civilian facilities were also targeted by the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes. Hospitals, schools, and power stations were bombed across Yemen, affecting lives of millions of Yemenis in a country already hit hard by poverty.
The Saudi-led coalition has deliberately targeted civilian facilities to kill civilians. It did not differentiate between civilian and military targets. The coalition has violated international laws that ban military attacks on civilian facilities.
However, infrastructure are not the only civilian targets hit by Saudi and coalition warplanes. According to the report, more than 500,000 homes have been destroyed during the war. As a result, millions of Yemenis have been displaced across the country.
The ongoing Saudi war and the blockade imposed on Yemen is killing more Yemenis, as it has deprived millions of civilians, including children, of their basic needs, such as food and medicine. However, the international community remains silent regardless of the situation in Yemen, which the United Nations describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Human rights organizations warn that the long-term Israeli blockade has led to deterioration of water crisis in Gaza, making the enclave's water undrinkable. The organizations also said the crisis has led to poisoning of the residents of the besieged enclave. The situation was exacerbated by an acute electricity crisis that hampered the operation of water wells and sewage treatment plants, leading about 80% of Gaza's untreated sewage to be discharged into the sea, while 20% seeps into underground water.
We suffer from shortage of water. Sometimes we are without water for weeks. Meanwhile, the available water is very salty, polluted, and unfit for daily uses, especially in the refugee camps. Palestinians here are forced to buy mineral water for drinking, but only a few of them can afford having it.
Israel's attacks on Gaza last May have doubled the crisis, as the attacks pounded the enclave's already crumbling infrastructure. This presents a serious threat to the Gaza population's health, where recent data indicates that about a quarter of the diseases spreading in Gaza are caused by water pollution, and a great number of deaths of young children and infants are linked to intestinal diseases related to polluted water.
Many children and elderly people are suffering from serious diseases due to the polluted water. Most of the families here go to hospitals on a weekly basis as they have kidney problems. We call on the International Human Rights Organization to support us.
The human rights groups also warn that the water crisis will lead to a catastrophe for the health system in the Gaza Strip, and called on the international community to pressurize Israel in order to guarantee Gazans' right to water security.
There are three centers for treating water in Gaza which need fuel. We can provide only 35% of the required amount of drinking water. The residents of Gaza cannot drink the water. Our underground water is also polluted and unfit for drinking, and most of the time we are forced to buy water.
Israel has deprived Palestinians of benefiting from the natural resources of water, which has led to a serious water security crisis in the Gaza Strip. The shortage of water is threatening the lives of 2 million Palestinians and has doubled the burden on the health system in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Recent developments in Afghanistan have marginalized attention to coronavirus crisis in the country. In the meantime, officials and doctors at Kabul's Afghan Japan COVID-19 hospital say new money has been paid to the hospital, pushing it further towards a closure.
We have many problems as the cold season is approaching. We expect another wave of the virus in coming weeks. We ask our ex-donors to pay the salaries of the employees. We can't run the hospitals on our own. If their assistance is not resumed, the only COVID-19 hospital of Afghanistan will close.
Patients getting treatment in the hospital complain about insufficient medical supplies and care. urging the international bodies to save the hospital from closing and so the lives of Afghans.
My father has contracted the coronavirus. We are here for weeks. Everything seemed okay, but today we see that the hospital suffers from lack of oxygen and medicines. Meanwhile, the doctors have not been paid for months.
This comes as the U.S. insists on freezing nearly $9.5 billion in assets belonging to the Afghan Central Bank and stopped shipment of cash to the nation. The U.S. says the assets will not be available to the Taliban, which remains on the Treasury Department's sanctions designation list. In addition to many humanitarian crises, the halt in global aid and the freezing of Afghanistan's assets have led to closure of most COVID-19 hospitals in the country. This comes amid warnings that Afghanistan could face COVID-19 outbreaks in the coming year. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Protecting press freedom. Supporters of the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange marching all the way to the British Royal Courts of Justice today ahead of an upcoming extradition hearing. The starting point, the BBC headquarters.
One of the main issues that we have with Assange is that his extradition, the case which is being heard next week, the whole basis of the case, the facts about the case, most of this never gets anywhere near the British media.
The U.S. government is attempting to extradite Assange under an old treaty with the U.K. for publishing damning documents of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and human rights violations elsewhere. His supporters say the charges are politically motivated.
It means basically that every journalist anywhere in the world has to be afraid of a possible extradition. Especially if he is reporting on national security issues, not just by the United States or other Western countries, but by any country.
Just last month, it was revealed that in 2017, as Assange began his fifth year holdup in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, the U.S. government plotted to kidnap or assassinate him on British soil. Still, the U.K. is carrying on with his trial.
It besmirches a reputation which at least the British establishment think they have got internationally. It's supposed to be a beacon of free speech. It's supposed to be a beacon of the free press. And while Julian Assange is in Belmarsh.
Since he was evicted from the Ecuadorian embassy 2 years ago, Assange has been languishing in a maximum security prison in southeast London. His next court hearing is set for October 27th and 28th. If extradited, he'll face 175 years in a U.S. prison.
It'll be a watershed moment in the most important press freedom case of the century. And these protesters say they're hoping that the U.K. government and justice system will do the right thing and put an end to what they describe as the show trial of Julian Assange. Site for Is Up, London.
In a press conference held by the Sudanese pro-civilian rule factions, the Force of Freedom and Change factions, FFC, has categorically rejected any move to dissolve the government without consent of the factions and Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. Meanwhile, an unarmed group stormed the building of the Sudan news agency Suna and used physical and verbal violence to terrorize journalists and media professionals in an attempt to prevent the convening of the conference, which had been announced earlier by FFC.
We in the Forces of Freedom and Change affirm our continuous support for Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and his government, who were chosen by the FFC to lead the transition in Sudan, and we reaffirm our full support and coordination with him.
Sudan has been grappling with the biggest political crisis in its 2 years old transition. The military and civilian groups have been sharing power in troubled alliance since long-standing President Omar al-Bashir was ousted in 2019. Observers believe that the only way out for Sudan's current crisis through expanding base of participation and unification of revolutionary forces.
I assure that there is no way out of this crisis without expanding the base of participation and rearranging the internal conditions of the forces of the Sudanese revolution as the guarantor of any real transformation in the political scene.
On the other hand, protesters from the splinter FFC faction, the National Charter Alliance, have been holding a sit-in outside Khartoum's presidential palace for the seventh day. with soldiers around the site providing protection.
Time is running out for all government components without reaching a solution for the political crisis, while FCC rejects all the mediation and solution made by the military before handing over the power to the civilian next month. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
A new poll shows that 3 out of every 4 French people believes that their purchasing power has diminished due to rising inflation, and 90% of the nation is worried about it. The nation's economy minister departed from his Western peers by admitting that inflation will continue to rise until 2023 at the earliest. Combined with unemployment, which was entrenched even before the coronavirus recession, the admission seems to announce the beginning of dreaded stagflation.
La vie est chère et encore plus à Paris.
Life is expensive, especially in Paris, from real estate to basic shopping needs to even the price of a simple lunch. Our purchasing power keeps going down.
The government has just announced a cap on household gas prices until the end of 2022. Natural gas has soared to record highs across Europe. They also announced a one-time payment of 100 euros to those who earn less than 2,000 euros per month, which amounts to 60% of the population. However, many say the one-off payment is not nearly enough.
Ça devient compliqué, ça diminue fortement.
No, it's not enough at all. When somebody is only taking home 2,000 euros a month, 100 euros isn't nearly enough to make difference when it comes to the energy costs. The government is not helping the middle class much at all.
The Yellow Vest protests, which initially kicked off 3 years ago due to rising fuel prices, just began what they called Season 2 last weekend. They are promising to continue marching. By a huge margin, purchasing power is the number one issue ahead of France's presidential election next year, just as it has been in all the elections since the great financial crisis began.
It's really fragile right now. The middle class just isn't seeing a fair relationship between their work and the amount they are paid.
Inflation is being reported seemingly worldwide, as the coronavirus lockdowns may have created a monetary monster. Many economists say the only solutions are controls on prices, as well as corporate profits, and higher wages, which have remained stagnant across the West for decades. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
This was the first face-to-face meeting of EU leaders since the bloc's energy crisis really came to the fore. Millions of citizens simply don't have the money to pay for electricity and gas bills, which have skyrocketed since the start of the year.
We will intensify our outreach to the different suppliers, also to diversify the supply we do have, and we have to speed up the work on interconnections.
Experts say Iran, with its enormous oil and gas reserves, is an obvious option for the EU. Illegal US sanctions are hampering exports, but that will change if the Iran nuclear deal is revived.
The real game changer will be if Iran comes into international market with full force, increasing its oil exports, increasing its gas production.
It has been confirmed that during their summit on Thursday and Friday, EU leaders debated erecting barbed wire along the bloc's external border to manage the refugee crisis, made worse by the situation in Afghanistan. Ursula von der Leyen says the idea is out of the question. On the subject of COVID-19, the EU has failed to convince citizens in some countries to take the vaccine. For example, the virus is now out of control in Romania and Bulgaria.
Some difficulties that are related to the vaccination hesitancy, and that's why it's also important to cooperate, to coordinate, in order to make also progress on this challenge.
Some EU nations want funding cut to Poland over alleged rule of law breaches. Right-wing leaders, such as Hungary's Viktor Orban, are dead against the move, though.
There is no need to have any sanction. It's ridiculous.
Germany's Angela Merkel, who gave her last press conference at an EU leaders' summit before leaving office, says she's also opposed to legal action against Warsaw. Apart from not meeting the needs of citizens and in turn allowing populism to take hold, critics say another key reason the EU is facing rule of law issues is because those running the project have been too eager to expand at all costs to create a superstate, and in the process have allowed countries to join that do not share EU values. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Administrative detention is permitted under international law, but only within the confines of extreme circumstances related to a national emergency and security purposes. The Zionist regime abuses this reasoning by declaring it is in an ongoing, that is, perpetual state of emergency. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Boxbaum, journalist. This article is published under the heading Palestinian Prisoners Under Zionist Regime Administrative Detention Continue Long and Brutal Hunger Strikes. Stay tuned for more. Palestinian prisoner Meqdad al-Khawasm has entered his 86th day on hunger strike. He is overcome with weakness and can't move from his hospital bed, not even to shower or use the bathroom. He suffers from joint, kidney, head, bone, muscular, and abdominal pain. He has trouble speaking and has lost more than 75 pounds. Despite his deteriorating health, Al-Khawasm won't end his hunger strike, as he and six other prisoners refuse food in protest of their ongoing administrative detention by the fake regime of Israel. Kayed Fasfus has been on hunger strike for 92 days. Ala al-Araj has spent 68 days without food. Hisham Abu Hawash started his hunger strike 61 days ago. Rayek Barat hasn't eaten for 56 days. Shadi Abu Akar is now in his 52nd day without food. And Hassan Shuka has been on hunger strike for 27 days. Additionally, at least 250 prisoners associated with the Islamic Jihad organization began a hunger strike on October 13th in protest of their relocation to isolated cells. The Zionist regime Supreme Court froze the detentions of both Al-Khawasme and Fasfus owing to their declining health. Al-Khawasme was detained on January 2nd and Fasfus was detained in July 2020. However, the prisoners' relatives and Palestinian government organizations say the Zionist regime decision isn't coming from a place of morality, but rather from liability concerns. The commission added that Fasfus's health is worsening with each day. The 32-year-old is persistently dizzy, has severe fatigue and chest pain, and his blood pressure and blood sugar levels are low. Fasfus also refuses to take supplements or undergo medical tests, saying he didn't suffer from health problems or illnesses prior to his arrest. Fasfus and Al-Khawasme were transferred from prison clinics to the Zionist regime hospitals. Al-Khawasme's mother, Hazm, told Mint Press News that the family received a permit to enter the occupied lands. The Israeli regime prison service wants to relieve their responsibility from his life in case anything happens, Hazm said. It's not a human rights thing, she added. The Zionist regime's policy of administrative detention allows it to imprison individuals indefinitely on secret information without charging them or allowing them to stand trial for a period of 6 months, with the possibility of renewal. Neither the detainee nor his attorney can access the classified evidence. While Israelis and foreigners can also be subject to administrative detention, the practice is mostly used against Palestinians. In September, Palestinian prisoner rights organization Adamir sent an urgent appeal to the United Nations to intervene and pressure the Zionist regime to end administrative detention. Adamir's letter emphasized the fact that administrative detentions have spiked recently. Milena Ansari, Adamir's international advocacy officer, said, "The Israeli regime occupation's use of administrative detention has drastically increased, especially this year, where arbitrary detention has been a key feature to maintain control over the Palestinians, especially with regards to what was happening in Al-Quds, Sheikh Jarrah, in the West Bank, and especially with the escape of six Palestinian prisoners from Gibola prison." In 2020, the Zionist regime issued at least 1,114 administrative detention orders against Palestinians, while no less than 759 administrative detention orders were issued from January through June 2021. Currently, 520 Palestinians are held in administrative detention. Ansari suspects the number of administrative detentions will continue surging before the year ends. What's become particularly concerning is the dramatic increase in Palestinian children held in administrative detention. Under the Freedom of Information Law, Israeli human rights organization HaMoked found three minors were administratively detained in January of this year. By June, that number has risen to eight. Amal Nakhle, 17, was arrested and placed in administrative detention on January 21, 2020. He was diagnosed with myasthenia gravis, a rare medical condition that requires constant medical care and monitoring. Even a child who suffers from health implications is subjected to administrative detention,
Ansari said, adding his detention has been renewed 3 times. So you can see the arbitrary use of this against children, where, according to international law, the detention of children should come as the last resort and for the least amount of time possible. But this is in complete contrast to the Israeli regime's use of administrative detention. Administrative detention is permitted under international law, but only within the confines of extreme circumstances related to a national emergency and security purpose. The Zionist regime abuses this reasoning by declaring it is an ongoing, that is, perpetual state of emergency. Amir argued in a July 2017 publication that the Zionist regime uses administrative detention as a form of collective punishment, noting how the number of administrative detainees soared to 8,000 during the First Intifada, a mass Palestinian uprising against the Zionist regime occupation lasting from 1987 to 1993. Following the Gibola prison break, more than 100 Palestinians were arrested, including family members of the escaped prisoners. And in May, the Zionist regime issued 155 administrative detention orders during the protest against the forced displacement of Palestinians in Al-Quds and the war on Gaza. According to Ha-Moket, more than 10% of Palestinians incarcerated by the fake regime of Israel are administrative detainees. Palestinian prisoners started executing hunger strikes in 1968 after the Zionist regime occupied the West Bank, Gaza, East Al-Quds as a way to protest ill treatment and conditions inside Israeli regime jails. This tactic later grew into demonstrating against administrative detention specifically. Palestinian prisoners' hunger strikes have had varying degrees of success throughout the decades. Some have managed to get their demands met, while others have been subjected to solitary confinement, forced feeding, and banned family visits. Adamir Zansari stated that hunger strikes are used as a last resort mechanism to gain adequate living standards in prison, explaining Palestinian prisoners have no other means to fight for their right but to use their own bodies as a tool. There is no judicial system to try them fairly. There is no party inside prison that can share their demands, so the sole item that they can use to protest and fight for their right is their bodies. We understand the controversy of how risky it is for their health, but this only makes us understand how desperate prisoners are to gain a bit of dignity when they are detained in Israeli regime prisons.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. After speaking about the political system and the Islamic approach to how a society needs to be governed, and how us as citizens of a society need to follow the authority that is placed upon us, as long as that authority has certain qualities. And these, of course, clear, obvious qualities and features, the most important of them needs to be them being just. Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli speaks about the social system in Islam and what kind of social awareness do we need to have, not only as far as interacting with other people, but also on the level of what kind of understanding do we need to have in contributing to making our society better. Ultimately, what all of us want is for us to live with a sense of harmony, with relying on that coexistence that is around us, the cohesion that is around us, and also feeling a level of security. Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli says, a society cannot be run in way of an eye for an eye, or you get exactly what it is that you have perpetrated, which as a result, you're going to get this kind of punishment. A society cannot function in a positive way if this was going to happen. And then he says that if it was the case that a society will function in such a way, then you're going to have millions and millions of lawsuits and court cases and problems that will be so continuous, it's never going to end. Although, he says, although you might be able to silence or calm parts of a society down, you will never be able to bring harmony. I think that's a very, very important point here. Some person might feel satisfied about them being able to, you know, retaliate to them being transgressed or wronged, but at the same time, you're not going to have an overall peace or harmony in the society. When the verse, for example, in the Holy Quran, Surah Ash-Shura, verse number 40, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that result or the outcome of a bad act is a bad act in retaliation, in equal to that. Now, of course, when you are going to repel bad with bad, what's going to happen in society? Of course, it's not something that we can see that exists in the spirit of Islamic akhlaq. And that's why ruh al-akhlaq of Islam is very important, and it plays a pivotal role in our understanding of sharia in general, ahkam, and also the social understanding of how we are able to deal with certain things like that. And that's why we need to always remember that we should never look at selective verses in the Holy Quran or the first half and not focus on the second half, or not focus on the ruh, the spirit of what it is that is being said. And that's why here it's important for us to continue on. You should continue on, وَيَدْرَؤُونَ بِالْحَسَنَةِ السَّيِّئَةَ, which means that through goodness, you are able to repel badness by forgiving, by forgetting, by minimizing the punishment, by allowing there to be some kind of flexibility in this area. Oh.
آیت الله جوادی آملی, the author of the book مفاتیح الحیات, the keys of life.
این مفاتیح باید دو جلد باشه, چندین سال این حرف گفته میشه.
This book مفاتیح ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است, چه فرون دماغ و صاحب داره فرون روزون است.
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرون درخکاری اینجا کم صاحب داره, دعا هم داره, صبا هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که رو گفته دارم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره, همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری و ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Justice itself is not enough. There always needs to be benevolence, ihsan, grace, compassion. There needs to be that always implemented in any of the understanding, which is exactly why it says وَيَدْرَؤُونَ بِالْحَسَنَةِ السَّيِّئَةِ, with akhlaq, with good understandings, with treating it in a very moral kind of process, we will be able to plant the seeds of goodness in our society, not the seeds of vengeful grudges that people are going to live with for generations. Again, talking about ihsan, talking about improving the level of social justice and allowing us to implement the Islamic understanding of how this is to be, where yes, things need to be placed in law, and the law of Islam dominates how the society is to function. At the same time, we also need to look between the lines. We also need to look at the spirit of Islam and understand what it is that Islam wants for us. We'll continue on with this topic in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's cries.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.